This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Peter McGillivray,
Jane Bolton,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Peter, we were talking about your lengthy time in, it was Massey Agricultural College, then Massey University.
Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't go straight to Massey University. I think, first of all, it went to Massey University of Manawatu, Massey University. It went to about four things within 18 months, and there are people who were there for three or four of those different institutions while it was coming through to be Massey University. A lot of coming and going about what the name should be.
So that wasn't restructuring, it was just thinking about the identity.
Yeah, the name, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know in my later days there, I started off in one department and I stayed with the same group of people and so on, but it changed the structure of the department, bringing people in from elsewhere, and agricultural economics merged with economics mm-hmm. merged with finance, and we talked about Department of Economics, Department of International, and Applied and International Economics. Just kept changing all the time, and then we shifted from the social science faculty to the business faculty.
Yes.
And then it became the College of Business, and change after change, rebranding each time. So you need all the new business cards.
And the early days for the business part of it was housed in the old hostel, was it? I don't know if you were here in that time.
Yes, there were some people still using that sort of...
Well, the old hostel were brought to Massey in 1928 from the Trentham military camp as a temporary measure to house students. And I think the last one was taken away well into the 80s.
Well, even now they've built the new... they were going in stages. They've built Business Studies West and Business Studies Central, but they were still using some sort of prefabricated huts for offices as well for a long time. So, yes. So you saw, obviously, a lot of changes there. Do you think... was there a big difference between it being an agricultural college and a university?
Yes. Major changes. The... new people coming on, and of course, to set up Massey and bring in new people, there was quite a lot of any change, of course, engenders opposition from other people, and the best thing that Massey ever did was to establish extramural teaching. And those people would come in, I think we referred to this earlier on, those people would come in and started to make a major change. Later on...
When you say those people came in, so special people came in, oh, you mean the students?
Yeah, the students, the extramural students came in. And they had to struggle because they only came in during the holidays, and I don't know what courses... were offered extramurally initially, but they weren't agricultural courses.
Yeah, there'd be printed material sent out, and then they would post in their assignments and so on, and then they would have on-campus courses. Now, I believe a lot of them were actually school teachers because they were paid to do extra teaching, extra training.
Oh, yes.
So it was, and they could move up the salary scale by getting...
Well, I remember one was history. Mm-hmm. And I had come round to the time of being able to get a bit of sabbatical leave. And when I was over in UK, I thought, oh, I better go to London and find out about the distance teaching that's happening over there with the Open University. Mm-hmm. They'll be far ahead of New Zealand. We're just a little colony starting out. But it was the other way around, particularly with history, which wasn't my subject at all, but one we just happened to be talking about. So Massey really broke new ground with that extramural teaching.
Yeah, I think the range of courses, but also a big difference compared to the Open University is that someone could be teaching a course internally in front of the students and also teaching the distance students. So you've got that broader interaction. But did you find even in the early days then that the distance students tended to be mature students who had life experience and work experience?
Oh, yes, very much so, very much so. And they quickly found out that if they could follow, upgrade their academic status through extramural teaching, it was very much to their advantage. So that gave it a great boost, really.
I certainly found that compared to youngsters who've gone straight from school and then they start studying, these were people who could challenge what they're being told and they have the application. So you say, well, in theory this, and they knew what it was like in practice.
And in the early days, Peter Crump, P.D.L. Crump, and Peter Freiburg, they really battled, they put their heart and soul into the establishment of extramural teaching. And I came across Peter Crump, particularly in organising their accommodation for the holidays.
Okay. So how was it a council decision to go extramural? Was it driven by the academic staff?
No. I really couldn't say, but they were wanting more students, of course. Bigger was better. And there was quite a lot of opposition, I think, from Victoria University at that stage. And I don't think it had much to do with agriculture. They weren't very much involved in the early days of extramural teaching.
Yeah. Now, I think Massey had a monopoly in it at one stage. The other universities weren't allowed to
teach. Absolutely, yes.
So were the staff, the academic staff, pleased to be doing that?
Some of them, yes. I can think of the fellow who did the first agricultural paper. He was quite a trailblazer. And establishing it and coming to grips with it and then being very successful at it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it limited their... just their time to do research if they were doing the distance teaching?
Oh, yes. Well, there's only a limited amount of time, and those who were doing the teaching of extramural, it was very much an extra burden to offer to do those courses.
I think later on it could be counted as you're doing an extra course by teaching in a distance mode, so it might lighten your load overall, because it means the total number of students that you have could be larger through
teaching them.
So was there much support for the lecturers when they were doing that? Now there's the central organisation for printing and distribution and overseeing all the distance teaching.
Well, you mentioned printing. Well, that was one of the things that, of course, promoted was necessary and helped promote extramural teaching was the Massey Printery, which beforehand was a pretty small operation. But by the time it had its own area and Peter Herbert was the printer, it was very much a part of Massey.
I know that the quality of printing and design and layout of the material that went out to students was greatly improved.
Improved year by year.
In fact, they got special design staff that were sorting those things out, which was quite impressive. Now it's all gone online, though. You see, lots of online material. So what was the on campus? Was there a vitality to it, or in hostels? Was there much going on there for the students, or they organised their own?
For the students at that time, no, it didn't really affect the students, except in they had to clear out their wardrobe or
push the stuff to us.
But no, they weren't mixing very much because it happened in the holidays
when
the students were absent.
So Now, was there good catering for the... So the distance students, they would come, they'd stay in the hostels.
Oh, yes.
Was there a cafeteria for this? This, are you talking about the 1960s?
Well, the cafeteria, that's interesting. Early on, in my time, in the 40s, there was no such thing as a cafeteria. And then when I was running the hostels as a senior warden, there had been a movement amongst the hostels committee to have a cafe. So we established one in the refectory, upstairs in the refectory. It was a very small operation for a start. And, of course, you had to have someone to run it. So, first of all, you got a student, and then we had a couple of girls who came in at night and ran the cafe.
Well, just a minute. Doesn't refectory mean a place to go to eat?
Well, it does. Oh, yes.
But there's nothing to eat there.
Not in those days.
Not initially.
So how did the students... What did they do for...
Oh, they enjoyed that. Well,
before then, what did they do?
Oh, yeah.
They cooked their own meals in a... Or...
Yeah, we had... there were little common rooms in the hostels.
Yeah.
In the pink hostel, which had the nicest common room, I don't think there was no cooking going on there.
How did they eat? Where did they get their
meals? Well,
the
main meals were at the refectory, but we're talking about the coffee bars.
Oh,
there was
okay.
No coffee bar.
So if they stay in hostel, then they're given breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Yes, and that was
but
it.
That's it.
That was
and
it.
And there was no way to buy alcohol on campus?
No, certainly not. That was a no-no.
No.
The vice principal of Massey, Professor William Radet, had a strong Scottish accent. And one of the things that I was able to do as a student, having got it from my parents, was put on a Scottish accent. And talking about booze on the campus, one day in the assembly hall, nice building, the assembly hall, right in the middle of the old building, we were waiting for some speaker to come, and I, as a cheeky young student, got on the stage and said, "There shall be no alcoholic liquor, and any student found in the girls' premises will be subject to instant dismissal." That didn't mean to say, of course, that there was no alcoholic on the hostels.
Yeah.
Or visiting.
And later, subsequently, many years later, again when I was responsible for the hostels, after the third term, the hostel buildings had a major clean-out. And one of the things associated with that was to get somebody up into the ceiling of the A, B and C rehab hostels to clear out the empties. And the young children of people like myself, wardens or staff of the hostels, they were very keen to get up there and get the bottles out, because I think you got a penny for a bottle. But one figure that sticks in my mind was 72 dozen was retrieved from the...
So the students weren't short of money then.
Oh, drink was pretty cheap, I think, in those days. Yes, yes, yes.
So did many students have cars then, or they used
no.
buses to get
No, they didn't have cars. Now, I finished up as a student in 1951, graduated in May 1952, and by then I think there were three cars, one of which was Scotty Munro's little two-seater car. I don't know if there was an item in the hostel rules at that stage, no cars, but very soon after... there was a strong point about no cars on the campus. That may have been influenced by the fact that Alan Stewart, the principal's car, well, he wasn't the principal then, but he was the senior lecturer in dairy husbandry, and he had a little car, like an Austin 7 or something, with flappy sides, and that was taken up to the second floor of the main building. So cars may have been important in his mind after that. But no cars were, and motorbikes in particular, they had to be left down at the front gate. Or down at the, there were some bike sheds down there, and the motorbikes could come as far as the bike sheds, but that was all.
So students would use motorbikes, bicycles?
Bicycles was the main...
The main one?
Yeah. Bicycle was the main form of transport, yeah. Yes.
So would they go into town very often?
As well as hitchhiking, that was the other one.
Okay.
Would they go into town very often? Not really. They would go in the weekend. They would go to the ANA dance, which was a favourite place. And then down near the showgrounds was the opposition one on a different night, the ANP dance. So that's what they would go in for, and to get ordinary supplies of academic type stuff, books and whatnot, clothing and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
So there weren't shops on campus?
Oh, no shop on the campus.
Okay.
There was the students' common room in the main building, which was there right from the very start, long before my time. There was a canteen there, and it was quite a competition for someone to get the job of running the canteen, and that would be cigarettes in particular. Soft drinks and the occasional book or pencils or rubbers and that sort of thing. A pretty small deal. It was a little opening in one corner of the student common room.
Okay. Now, that's interesting then, because one big issue for a lot of campuses would be that the university bookshop, you have courses and there are textbooks, so they have to buy those books. And for a bookshop, knowing what the courses are and just getting the stocks in and selling a whole load of books in a week or two, it was a good money.
No, I don't think there was any books sold through the canteen. All that happened at Bennett's, G.H. Bennett.
Was that in town, though?
That was in town,
so they
yes.
didn't have a campus?
No.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And, of course, there were far fewer books around then,
yes,
textbooks around then, than there are subsequently.
Now, you mentioned if there were hardly any cars, I know that there had been a swimming pool which was filled in and made into a car park.
Oh,
so was it there as a swimming pool?
The swimming pool was very important. One member of my class, was a very loud-mouthed student. He had a lot to say for himself. And on his first day at Massey, he found himself being carried over and thrown into the swimming pool.
This is when you were a student?
Yeah, a student.
Okay, yeah.
But the swimming pool had been made by early students, and when there must have been a great camaraderie and support from the students then in any way to help promote Massey. And subsequently, when the swimming pool was taken away, they found that the reinforcing was old fencing, old wire netting, and it was a wonder that the whole thing held together. But people would come out from town, particularly young kids would come out from town to the swimming pool, and it was very much a gathering point.
Was there a pump and filtration system? Or?
No, you emptied the pool when it got a little bit soupy. There was no pump
okay.
to think of.
And refilling.
But it was a lovely pool.
Yeah.
And
The Lido in...
No.
No, there was the Ashley Street Baths, was there?
I don't think the Lido... No, there was nothing like that. There would be other baths in town.
Yeah, I think the Ashley Street, there was a bit... Behind the opera house, is it?
Oh, yes. There could have been, yes.
A big one at one
But, Peter, when Stuart Chambers was here, he had an old Land Rover. So what was that, 1958?
Well, 1958. Well, he would have to have parked that off the campus.
Oh, I must ask
him
about that.
Yes, I doubt that he would have been had permission to do that. Because that was... Jeff Wilson, the warden, had just sort of finished up, senior warden for many years, who was a great figure of fun with the students. He had gone, and there was a fill-in with Joe Hughes and Jim Keir, and they were really not there for very long. And then I came on the scene, and there was no cars on campus at that stage. Mm. Yes.
I know you said a lot of the students used to borrow his Land Rover.
Oh, yes.
Sometimes bring it back with petrol, sometimes without.
Oh, yes, yes.
Filled up. Mm.
Okay. So, now, process, was that just
before? Process was a major operation. And there were a couple of army huts up behind the Pink Hostel, tucked into a hedge there, where the good items from one process were kept over to the following year for the material for the next process. And the first thing you had to do if you were the process controller was to jack up lorries to take the edifices that were put on top of them, and great support from the town.
So what was process?
Process was the students would take over the square for a day associated with capping. And capping was a major thing from the point of view of the students.
Graduation.
And there were some gifted people there who wrote the review. The review was put on in the Opera House. And that was written by students. Mm. And that would be at the end of the first term. So they only had one term to make up the script. And some of them were absolutely brilliant. Shortly after my time there, one of them was John Reed, who subsequently became a Rhodes Scholar and a brilliant academic in the business world in New York. That was one year, for example, I can think of very, very good reviews. But the most notable one, of course, was Tom Scott, the cartoonist.
Yes.
He
wrote things for Process. I know there was the student newspaper.
Masquerade.
Student magazine.
Masquerade, yes. He contributed to that for about 3 years or more.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, more than that.
But he also did the sort of things for the Process itself.
Oh, yes. He was prominent in anything to do with taking the mickey out of people, including myself. Because we had, we developed when the vets came, the ag vet debate, and Tom Scott was on the vet side, and I happened to be on the ag side.
So they set up the vet school at Mercy quite late then, did they? And you had an annual debate between...
Oh, yes, that was just subsequent. That was just a small student thing, the debate.
Okay. So was he a vet student?
He was a vet student, yes.
Okay.
Oh.
He didn't finish then, or he just decided...
Oh, no, he didn't finish, no.
Okay.
He
found other things.
So
that were more fun.
So capping week was a big issue, a big thing for the students. First of all, it was two or three people would write the review script. Then they would recruit people to act that on the stage of the Opera House. And then it culminated in the Massey Ball. And one of my class, who is still with us today, age 94, became the ball controller for quite a few years. And he claims he's been a very good organiser in the agricultural field, both in New Zealand and overseas. And he claimed that his training for that was doing the Massey Ball. And he was successful at it. So when he finished a student at Massey, he was employed in Palmerston North and kept on being the ball controller for two or three years afterwards.
Yeah.
And they were at one stage, they were black tie affairs. We really brushed up for the ball.
So was that just a university event, or does the town participate?
No, just university.
Just
university, just students and staff would come along to the ball. And there was in the staff, there's always those who are close to students, involved in student affairs and others. But the ones who were close to staff were very much involved in all these things. And... they were members of staff were so, unfortunately picked upon either in the skits that took place or in the dialogue.
And you were picked on for one of these by Tom Scott?
In the debate, yes,
ah, okay.
yes. It doesn't be a repetition, no. yes.
Okay. Now, was Tom Scott doing all sorts of cartoons then as well?
No, not that I remember. He probably had cartoons in Masquerade.
Yes.
I can't remember that. Yes.
Yeah, I heard there was something like an issue that was banned or something.
Oh yes. It was a major issue. We could get the details from Drawn Out, a book written by Tom Scott, which at the moment is sitting on my bed and I'm three quarters of the way through.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So what is the, just very briefly, so there's a book by Tom Scott called Drawn Out.
Written a number of books.
Oh, okay. That was describing the
That was about his life. Including bits about Massey.
Okay.
Yes.
So why was it banned? Was it, he was doing something that was scandalous at the time?
It was about Muldoon.
Yes,
He had a favourite target, which was Muldoon, who subsequently banned him from any interview.
All the press. Yes.
His contribution was cartoons and that sort of stuff, but there were other major contributions. One was a fellow in my class, Kevin O'Connor, went on to be a professor of high country studies at Lincoln. He wrote a whole review and the songs that went with it. In my city of the plains, where farmers' sons are taught the fruits of learning, in my city of the plains, la 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 for burning. Now, he wrote song after song. Din Richardson, John Reed again. Joe Hughes was the one of the big items in review was the ballet, and so you'd get these big hairy legged fellows, including my roommate Dave Joblin, who was a bigger fellow than me and had lots of hair, and he was one of the massive fairies. So the ballet was always very well received.
You've got these big, hefty, farming-type guys being ballerinas.
In their blue and white tutus, massy colours, blue and white tutus, yes, they were good.
So were they very skilled at this? Or?
Oh, they were quite good, actually. They had one of the women from town who was a ballet mistress.
Yeah.
She was roped in to train them, and they would have quite a few practices, rehearsals, yes. That was the ballet.
Okay.
And the procession, you're asking about procession, that was the trucks with buildings on them, the massive band was part of that, and they would go round the square, and when they were going round the square, all the other supporters would be going, dressed up as hoodlums or something, going into the shops, rattling their tins, and getting money for some charity that they decided on for that year.
Didn't they sell the magazine at the same time? Were they selling the magazine?
Yes, yes.
Don't remember that.
But then in the end it all stopped.
For example, when you graduated, when I graduated in 1952... you had the official graduation and your cap put on top of you, and then you walked, and then you were accosted by somebody from the student body who gave you something relative to what you did at Massey. So that if you'd been a great drinker, for example, there was some contribution made about that. If you'd been a great girl man, it'd be something there. And that was knocked on the head very quickly when Dr. Alan Stewart, who as a student who'd been very much involved in that sort of thing, knocked that on the head, quite probably too, as the place developed. Yes.
Yeah. But it wasn't the town reacting to the student.
No. The town quite looked forward to it, really. And there was nothing. I don't recall any incident as a result of that.
Mm. But it just died out in the end.
Yes.
Didn't the magazine got it pretty bawdy, didn't it, in the
end? Oh, yes. Tom Scotland made that.
That got a bit...
And there was a sort of graduation ball, but you had about 20 female students and 300 male.
Oh, well, the 300 male soon
they did mingle with some from the town.
Oh, yes. Well, the ball was a nice event, nice event. Yeah.
They had the nurses, didn't they? And they had the training college girls from the teachers' training college. So they were pretty well catered for.
So there was a big mess. So it wasn't just the university here,
This is part 5 of 6. Listen next week for part 6.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.